Does that mean that it would be sufficient for the monk to tell his thoughts aloud, even when alone? Of course not. The presence of somebody, even if he does not speak, even as a silent presence, is requested for this kind of confession. Because the Abba, or the Father, who listens at this confession, is the image of God, and the verbalization of thoughts is a way to put under the eyes of God all the ideas, images, suggestions, as they come to consciousness, under this divine light, they show necessarily what they are. From this we can briefly conclude, one, that verbalization in itself has an interpretative function. It detains in itself a power of diacrisis, of differentiation, of discretion. Two, this verbalization is not a kind of retrospection about past acts. It has to be a permanent activity as contemporaneous as possible of the stream of thoughts. The monk has to tell to the Father omnes cogitationes, all his thoughts. Three, this verbalization must be exhaustive, but it must go also as deep as possible in the depth of the thoughts. These, whatever they are, have an inapparent origin, an obscure root, secret paths, and that's the point the verbalization must put in light. Four, as verbalization brings to the external light the deep movement and the obscure roots of the thought, it leads also, and by the same process, the human soul from the reign of Satan to the law of God. The path from night to light of the consciousness is also the path from Satan to God. That means that verbalization is a way for the metanoia, for the conversion, for the rupture of the self. It's a way for the conversion to develop itself and to take effect. Since under the reign of Satan, the human being was attached to himself, the verbalization as a movement towards God is a renunciation to Satan. Verbalization is a renunciation to Satan, but it is also, and for the same reason, a renunciation to oneself. Verbalization is a self-sacrifice. To this permanent, to this exhaustive, to this deep, to this sacrificial verbalization of the thoughts, the Greek fathers gave the name of hexagoresis. Thus, as you see, in the Christianity of the first centuries, the obligation to tell truth about oneself was to take two major forms, exomologesis, publicatio sui, and hexagoresis, exhaustive verbalization. Exomologesis, publicatio sui, and hexagoresis are very different from one another. On one hand, exomologesis, a dramatic expression by the penitent of his status of sinner, and this in a kind of public manifestation. On the other hand, hexagoresis, an analytical and continuous verbalization of the thoughts, and this in relation of complete obedience to the will of somebody else. But it must be remarked that this verbalization, as I just told you, is also a way of renouncing self and no longer wishing to be the subject of the will. Thus, the rule of confession inherent to hexagoresis finds its parallel in the model of martyrdom which haunts exomologesis. The ascetic maceration exercised on the body and the obligation of verbalization applied to the thoughts, those two things, somatic macerations and verbalization, are symmetric. They are supposed to have the same goals and the same effects. So much that one can isolate as a common element to both practices, the following exomologesis and exagoresis, publicatio sui and verbalization. To both practices, we can apply this, we can find in, as nucleus of those two practices the following principle: the revelation of the truth about oneself cannot be dissociated from the obligation to renounce the self. We have to sacrifice the self in order to discover the truth about oneself. And we have to understand this sacrifice not only as a radical change in the way of life, but as the consequence of a formula like this: you will become the subject of the manifestation of truth about yourself on the condition you renounce being the subject of your own will, be it by obedience to the other or by the symbolic staging of your own death in the publicatio sui. Facere veritatem, to make the truth about oneself, is impossible without this sacrifice. Let's stop here. I have been both too long and much too schematic. Please consider all what I have said only as a point of departure, one of those small, tiny origins that Nietzsche liked to discover at the beginning of great things. The great things that those monastic practices announced are numerous. I'll mention just before I finish a few of them. One, the apparition of what we could call the gnoseologic self. You remember what I told you yesterday. The Greek technologies of the self tended to produce what I called a gnomic self, a permanent superposition in the form of memory of the subject of knowledge and of the subject of the will. You remember what I have indicated in the beginning of this lecture? In the movements of the gnostic type, it was a question of constituting an ontological unity, the knowledge of the soul and the knowledge of the being, and then would be constituted what we could call the gnostic self in Christianity. One sees the development of a much more complex technology. This technology first maintains the difference between knowledge of the self and knowledge of the being, and that's the main difference with the gnostic self, gnostic technology of the self. And this knowledge of the self takes shape in the not in the identification between will and truth as in the gnomic self. It takes shape in the constitution of thoughts as subjective data which are to be interpreted. And the role of interpreter is assumed by the work of a continuous verbalization of the most imperceptible movements of the thought. That's the reason why we could say that the Christian self, which is correlated to these techniques, is a gnoseological self. The second point, which seems to me important, is this. There have been in early Christianism a perpetual oscillation between a truth technology of the self oriented towards the manifestation of the being, the exomologesis, what we call, and this exomologesis, we could call it the ontological temptation of Christianity. There was an oscillation between this technology of the self, following the exomologesis, and a truth technology oriented towards the discursive analysis of the thought. I mean the exagoresis. We could call it the epistemological temptation of Christianism. And as you know, after a lot of oscillation, a lot of conflicts and fluctuation, the second, the exagoresis, the epistemological temptation of Christianism, became victorious. Three, even in this hermeneutical techniques, derived from exagoresis, the production of truth could not be met without a very strict and imperative condition, As we saw, hermeneutics of the self implies the sacrifice of the self, and of course, a non-identity processus. And that is, I think, the deep contradiction, or if you want, the greatest richness of the Christian technologies of the self. No truth about the self without the sacrifice of the self. The centrality of confession of sins in Christianity, finds here its explanation. The verbalization in confession of sins is institutionalized as a discursive truth game, which is a sacrifice of the subject who is just speaking. Fourth and last point. I think that one of the great problems of the Western cultures have been to find the possibility of founding the hermeneutics of the self not on the sacrifice of the self, but on a positive, on a theoretical and practical emergence of the self. A trend towards an identity technology of the self, and not a sacrificial technology of the self. That was the aim of the judicial institution from the middle of medieval ages. It was also the aim of the medical and psychiatric and psychologic practices since the end of the 18th century. That was also the aim of the political and philosophical and epistemological theory from the 17th century. That is, I think, the ground, the deep root of what we could call the permanent anthropologies of the Western way of thinking. I think that this anthropologies, this trend towards an identity technology and towards the theory of man as the root of an hermeneutic of the self, I think that that is linked to the situation, to the heritage of Christianity. It is linked to this deep desire of the modern Western society, this deep desire to substitute the positive figure of man to the sacrifice, which was for the Christianity the condition of the opening of the self as a field of indefinite interpretations. Or we can say that the problem of one of the problems of Western cultures was this one: how could we save the hermeneutics of the self and get rid of the necessary sacrifice of the self, which was linked to this hermeneutics since the beginning of Christianity? During the two last centuries, the problem has been what could be the positive foundation for the technologies of the self that we have been developing during centuries and centuries. But the moment is coming maybe for us to ask another question. Is this hermeneutics of the self worth to be saved? Do we need still really this hermeneutics of the self we have inherited from the first centuries of Christianity? Do we need a man, a positive man, to serve as the foundation of this, those hermeneutic of the self? If the problem about the self, maybe the problem about the self is not to discover what it is, but maybe to discover that the self is nothing else than the correlative of technology built in our history. And then the problem is not maybe to find a positive foundation for those interpretative technology. Maybe the problem is now to change those technologies, or maybe to get rid of those technology, and then to get rid of the sacrifice which is linked to those technologies. In this case, one of the main political problems would be, in the strict sense of the word politics, the main political problem would be the politics of ourselves. Thank you for your attention.